This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. Since Congress passed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act 30 years ago, lawmakers have changed FISA dozens of times without anyone paying much attention. Not this time. For months, Congress and the White House have been at loggerheads over how to amend the law that tells the president when he needs a court warrant to eavesdrop on phone or email conversations. Generally, the rule has been if the president wants to spy on people overseas, he doesn't need anybody's permission. If he wants to spy on Americans in the U.S., he needs to go to a secret court in the Justice Department and ask a judge for a warrant. Amending the law this time has been more difficult than anyone expected. A stopgap measure has expired, and the White House says a permanent law has to protect telephone companies that cooperated with the government's secret warrantless spying program after 9/11. The Senate passed a bill that gives those companies retroactive protection. The House did not. Now the House and Senate are trying to find common ground, and they say they could reach an agreement this week. Later this hour on the Talk of the Nation opinion page, who will govern the new religious right? But first, the debate over the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Our guests today arguably know more about FISA than anyone else in the country. That includes our first guest, Assistant Attorney General Ken Wainstein. He leads the Justice Department's National Security Division, and he joins us here in Studio 3A. Welcome to Talk of the Nation, Ken.
Thanks, Ari. Good to be here.
If you'd like to talk with Mr. Wainstein about FISA reform, give us a call at 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org, or you can weigh in on our blog at Blog of the Nation. And Ken, as I mentioned, Congress passed a temporary spying bill called the Protect America Act that expired last month. You said that since that act expired, intelligence has been lost. Last week, a group of former intelligence officials said in a letter that the sunset of the Protect America Act does not put America at greater risk. So explain the difference here. Why do you believe those officials are wrong?
Well, I think it's important to look at the terms of the Protect America Act. The Protect America Act, as you said, expired. However, there are transition procedures in that statute that allows any surveillance is being done under that act at the date of the expiration to continue up to a year from when the initial directives were put in place.
So that would be up to August of 08.
Well, yes, up to August of 08 for any directives that were gotten back in August of 07. Yes, in terms of the surveillances that are being done under the Protect America Act, everybody acknowledges that those will continue. The problem is that doesn't cover the waterfront for a number of reasons. One, we will want to go up on new surveillances, and for the first week after the expiration, we had some problems with some of the providers, communications providers, who did not want to start new surveillances. They had some concern that the law wouldn't have protected them from liability if they went up on new surveillances under the orders that were or the directives that were put in place under the Protect America Act. We had to work it out with the general counsel's offices for them to see that, yes, they would be protected, and then they agreed to go up. So for that first week, we were missing certain surveillances that we otherwise would have been on.
But even without the Protect America Act, the old Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act still existed. Can you explain why intelligence was falling through the cracks, even though there was a law in place designed to govern collection of intelligence?
Right. And this goes to the sort of longer-term question of, okay, even once we reached agreement with the general counsels of all the providers, on the new surveillances, the problem is that going forward, if we want to, let's say, go up on a new provider, a provider who wasn't covered under one of the earlier directives, there's some question about whether we'd be able to do that under the law. Even if we tried to, the provider might litigate it, and so we might be delayed in being able to go up, and so we might then have to rely on old traditional FISA, which is a fine tool. It served America well. The problem is it's quite cumbersome. It requires us to establish probable cause before we go up on a foreign target overseas, which I think, as you said in your intro, was never the intention of the FISA statute. The FISA statute was designed in a way to make us go to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court and establish probable cause that a particular person is an agent of a foreign power if we want to target someone in the United States. But if that person is outside the United States, it was contemplated that we wouldn't have to do that. We could do it just for any legitimate foreign intelligence reason. If we have to go through old FISA, we have to show that probable cause. We might not be able to do that in certain cases, in which case we won't be able to do valid surveillances. Even if we can, it means we've got to devote all the analysts, agents, lawyers to generating these voluminous packages to then send these packages, applications to the FISA court and to get the FISA court's approval. It slows us down. And that was the problem that led to the Protect America Act in the first place, that the FISA requirements, as applied to overseas surveillances, prevented us from going up on a significant amount of surveillance. So the more we rely on FISA, the original FISA, the more we're going to slip back toward that intelligence gap that caused such concern last summer.
So just to sort of encapsulate what's happening today, the Protect America Act has expired, but eavesdropping orders that were approved under the earlier Protect America Act continue up for a year. If you want to go for new ones, you have to do it under the old FISA law. And it sounds as though you've reached an agreement with the telecom companies from what you're saying. When you go and talk to these phone companies, these email service providers, and they say there's some ambiguity and they're not sure what to do, how does that conversation go? What are you hearing from them?
Well, that's actually the point that we're trying to make. We can't do these surveillances without the communications providers. They own the communications system. We have to go to them and seek their assistance. They have their first obligation to their shareholders. They are all good American, you know, patriotic companies. They do their best by us, but they still have a fiduciary duty to their shareholders. So the first thing they've got to do is make sure that they're not exposing themselves to any litigation risk, let's say, by agreeing to help us. Well, when you have a good statute that's in place, that's, you know, without question, that lays out a lawful path towards this assistance, no problem. They go ahead and provide us the cooperation. They do so in a way that allows us to do this quickly and seamlessly. However, if you don't have a statute in place, like now where the PAA, Protect America Act, has expired, they have concerns. They're worried that there might be, they might end up facing a lawsuit if they assist. So they're more, for good reasons, more risk averse. Therefore, they're more likely to litigate if we ask them to do something, which then slows us down and actually prevents us from going up in that surveillance. So that uncertainty is something that we really want to see come to an end with permanent legislation.
I want to get into more detail about lawsuits and this issue of immunity in just a second, but first let's go to a caller. This is Alan in Eden Prairie, Minnesota. Hi, Alan. Hi, Alan, are you there?
Actually, this is Sierra from Tallahassee.
Oh, sorry about that. Sierra, go ahead.
Okay. Hi, I had a question. From what I understand from everything I've read, the things that the telecom companies were asked to do that everyone's currently screaming about not wanting to give them immunity for is stuff that was, under FISA, old FISA rules, illegal. And Quest actually was the only one who said, you know what, no, this is illegal and we're not going to do it. What I don't understand is why the current argument over what should be made legal and what the telecom agency should be allowed to do or not allowed to do should have anything to do with what they did previously. Because, I mean, they have lawyers on staff. That's what they're paid to do.
Okay.
To look at things like that and say, you know what, I don't care if you're from the U.S. government. That's not legal.
And Sierra, let me put that question to Ken Weinstein, who's here in the studio with us. Ken, you want to address that?
Yeah, thanks for the question. The people have debated the legality of what went on under the terrorist surveillance program, and I think I'll leave that to others right now. But bottom line is that the providers, the communications providers who were asked to assist in that program, were shown were told and given documents that showed that this had been determined to be legal at the highest levels of the government, and that there was a program that was authorized by the president. Based on that, the Senate Intelligence Committee, who saw these documents and knew about the program itself, know all the details of the program, determined that the communications providers who assisted in that program had done so in good faith, and so therefore they should not have to face liability. Based on that finding, the Senate Intelligence Committee voted out a version of the bill that has this immunity in it by a margin of 13-2. And we've now
explained why Quest thought it was illegal in the first place. I mean, there was obviously some question about it.
Right. I'm not going to get into who thought what about the legality of the program, but the bottom line is, for purposes of this immunity debate, that the providers who rendered assistance and did so in the aftermath of 9/11 when we needed their help did so based on assurance that this was completely lawful, had been authorized from the top of the government, and was necessary for our efforts against terrorists.
Okay, Sierra, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Ken, the president has said that a new FISA law has to include immunity for telephone companies. And he's also said that American lives are at risk if we don't have a new FISA law. So some people have asked the question, is this issue of telephone company immunity so important that it's worth putting American lives at risk for?
Well, the immunity issue is absolutely critical. And I guess I've sort of tried to telegraph that in my answers here. bottom line is it's a matter of basic fairness, as I alluded to in my answer to the last caller. I mean, these were companies that stepped up and responded to our call for assistance. And so now it's, I think, patently unfair to be holding them liable for assisting us. But then beyond that, what it's, I think, important for people to recognize is that, as I said earlier, we rely on these providers for their assistance. We cannot do it without them. And if they have this immunity, I mean, this liability, which is in the multi-billions of dollars, and that's looming over their head, they've got, and that we then come and ask them for more assistance, that's going to make them understandably skittish and make them understandably risk-averse and understandably more inclined to litigate and reduce their cooperativeness with us. And that the less cooperation we get from the providers, the harder it is for us to track these guys in real time.
Just briefly, Senator Patrick Leahy, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, says this impasse has less to do with the ins and outs of surveillance and more to do with the administration's efforts to avoid accountability for the unlawful surveillance of Americans. How do you respond to that?
Well, I've actually appeared and had a number of hearings up on the Hill and appeared before Chairman Leahy and his colleagues, and we had a good, healthy debate on this issue. The reality is we're not saying that this litigation, that someone can't file a complaint. We just say, look, the providers here, they acted in good faith. They shouldn't be held accountable. They shouldn't go through the embarrassment, the disruption. They shouldn't go through the jeopardy, the fact that, you know, if they're identified as having cooperated with us against terrorists, they might have persons and facilities jeopardized by that. They shouldn't have to go through that. They can a person who feels that they're aggrieved can sue the government, and if there's fault, the fault in anybody's eyes would be with the government that authorized and gave assurances to these providers.
We've been talking with Assistant Attorney General Ken Wainstein. He leads the Justice Department's National Security Division, and he joined us here in 3A. Thanks for being here. We're talking about the contentious debate over the renewal of the FISA law, what's at stake, and we're taking your calls at 1-800-989-8255. Do you care about this issue? Why? You can send us an email at talk@npr.org. I'm Ari Shapiro. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. We're talking about electronic eavesdropping this hour and Congress's efforts to craft a new version of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. How important is this issue to you? Let us know at 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. You can send an email to talk@npr.org, and you can also read what other listeners have to say at npr.org/blogofthenation. Our next two guests bring a different perspective to the spying debate. Jim Baker spent almost a dozen years working at the Justice Department's Office of Intelligence Policy Review. That's the office that actually submits wiretap applications to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. And Jim, thanks for being here in 3A. And I understand congratulations are in order because you will soon start a job working in Verizon's General Counsel's office.
Yes, Ari, thank you. And just to be clear, anything I say today is in my personal capacity and doesn't necessarily reflect the views of the company.
Understood. Thank you. Other guest here in Studio 3A is Kate Martin, Director of the Center for National Security Studies, a civil liberties group. Welcome, Kate.
Thank you.
Jim, I'd like to start with you with an email that we received from a listener. This is from Robert in Lafayette, California, and he says, I'm a loyal American with ancestors who fought in the Revolutionary War, and the very idea of a secret court causes me to bristle with indignation that such a thing could even exist in the United States. He asks, how can any American condone secret courts for any reason at any time? I don't like it. I don't accept it as constitutional, and I never will. Well, Jim, you appeared before this secret court in the Justice Department for years, asking for warrants for eavesdropping. Can you explain why you think this secret court is important and why people have signed on to it for the last 30 years?
Sure, Ari. I mean, on the one hand, I guess my main point, the main takeaway point I would make is that the system works, the FISA system works, in the sense that we were able to obtain actionable foreign intelligence information quickly from the court, and the American public had the confidence that that what was going on was being reviewed within the Justice Department, was being reviewed by a separate independent court. The essential dilemma is, and this starts back in 1978, was on the one hand, we want to protect the country from very real threats from abroad. We need to do that. And we don't want to tell our adversaries what it is that we're doing in very great detail. We don't want to tell them who we're targeting. We don't want to tell them how we do it. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, there were a number of different abuses going back to the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s that were uncovered that NSA and other other intelligence agencies had been involved with. And so we wanted to protect the American, Congress wanted to protect the American people from abuses by those agencies. So what do you do to try to reconcile those two things? What the president and Congress came up with was this sort of middle ground where you have a secret court that is opaque from public view, but at the same time, it's being reviewed by Justice Department people. The Attorney General has to sign the applications. There's other mechanisms for accountability. And there are independent judges reviewing each and every one of these applications. That was the solution for that, or the resolution to that dilemma that the writer points out.
And so it sounds like now everybody has signed on to the idea of this secret Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. The big question is what kinds of questions should come before that court and what kinds of questions should that court have to answer? Kate, this issue has been on the table for 30 years since the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act was passed. Can you describe why you think, after 30 years, the amendment to this act, the update of this act, has become suddenly so contentious and really consumed Washington?
Well, it's interesting because many of the provisions of the Patriot Act were, in fact, amendments to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. I think it's basically about the president's claim that he has the authority to wiretap Americans without a warrant. And as you know, that was revealed by the New York Times in December of 2005. It's not about wiretapping, and we have to be clear here, it's not about wiretapping people overseas. Mr. Weinstein this morning acknowledged the FISA has never been about telephone calls between two people overseas. The FISA is about protecting Americans when the government wants to listen to their phone calls or communications with people overseas. And what the FISA said was we'll have a court issue a warrant, which we believe the Fourth Amendment requires, and which it also had the other salutary effect that it gave the telephone companies certainty. The other thing about the telephone companies, because these two issues are related, is that the law, the telephone companies have an obligation not to allow your international communications, my international communications, to be accessed by anyone, including the United States government, including the president, except in the narrow circumstances set forth in the law. This president claimed the authority to ignore that law. And the question in Congress is, A, the telephone companies were supposed to tell him, hey, you want to listen to Americans? Show me the court order. They didn't. And not for a month, and not for a year. For 6 years, they did that. And secondly, the question now is, so we have these changes in technology, et cetera. Do we need to change the law? But how do we do that and keep the protections for Americans' international communications?
There's something I would like to clarify, because you talked about eavesdropping on Americans without a warrant. And as I understand it, the major change from the older version of FISA and the newest version is that before, when the government wanted to eavesdrop on somebody overseas calling an American, and the person overseas was of primary interest to them, they had to go to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court to get a warrant. Now, as I understand it, on the newest version of FISA, as long as the person overseas is the target, even if the person they're calling happens to be in the United States, a warrant is no longer necessary under the Protect America Act. Let's take a caller. This is Jim from Oklahoma City. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. My question relates to earlier conversation you were having about the immunity provisions for the phone companies. And what I don't understand is why the Bush administration and some members of Congress don't trust the judiciary. Because if your earlier person you had on there was right about how they were acting in good faith and everybody believed that they were following the law, why wouldn't the courts do what was right and proper? And if they're wrong about that, then it seems to me that the courts would be the place to resolve that, that in fact they were doing something wrong.
I think that is exactly, you've hit the nail on the head, that it's a long time until there's a resolution in the court. We have a system where when Americans claim with a lot of evidence that the government's been secretly and illegally wiretapping them, they get to go to court. And the telephone companies had a legal and fiduciary obligation to protect their customers' privacy. The claim is that they violated that and the courts should decide it.
There's
my thought is if they violated the law and violated my rights, I would like them to be held accountable. And if they didn't and what they were doing was proper, then, you know, the courts is the place to decide that, not the Congress and not the administration.
Jim Baker?
Well, I just want to – there's another issue at play here that I'm not sure Ken addressed, but there is this issue of the risk of disclosing sensitive sources of methods in federal courts. Now, for years and years in criminal cases and in civil cases, we've had rules that protect classified information in courts. So those have worked effectively. But there's always a risk. And so that is one of the other issues that people have focused on in terms of the danger with letting litigation go forward.
I might just point out, though, that what seems to be the risk here is that the scope of the illegal wiretapping by this administration is still a secret. And that, I suggest to you, is the biggest secret they're trying to keep, and not the details of how the technical wiretapping occurs, which, of course, should be kept secret.
Jim, thanks a lot for your call.
The courts can work that out because, I mean, that's what they're designed to do, to determine what can be heard and what can't be heard, what's proper, what's improper. I mean, that's... Again, it seems to me that the court would resolve that.
Okay, thanks, Jim, for your call.
Thank you.
Sandy from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, sent an email saying, I admit I'm a little ignorant on this issue, but are there stipulations in the FISA law that this is solely for the purpose of getting terrorist intelligence, or can the government use any information they find as they wish? For instance, if they happen to undercover drug dealing, would that be allowable in court? Jim, you've dealt with just this issue for many years. You want to take this?
Any information you obtain from a FISA has to be used and may only be used for lawful purposes. Those lawful purposes can include criminal prosecution for something else. So if you're listening on a wiretap to somebody that you think is involved in terrorist activities or espionage, and they happen to have a side deal going with drugs or white-collar fraud or something like that, there are rules. But the basic idea is, yes, you can use that. Using information from a FISA in a criminal court is a lawful purpose, so therefore it's okay. You couldn't use it for blackmail, though, for example. You have to use it for a lawful purpose.
We have many callers who are concerned about spying on political groups, political adversaries, for example. Does that fall under the legal heading that you're describing?
Well, in that sense, yes. I mean, you're not supposed to be – in order to get a FISA warrant – a FISA order, you have to establish probable cause to believe that the person is an agent of a foreign power or a foreign power. Those are defined terms in the statute, and an American cannot be an agent of a foreign power based solely on their First Amendment activities. So the idea is that the statute's definitions provide the protection.
Of course, all of those definitions have been done away with by the Protect America Act, which no longer requires probable cause and doesn't require that the surveillance be limited to terrorism purposes. It's simply for really broad, quote, foreign intelligence purposes. And while they couldn't spy for political purposes, the fact of the matter is that when the NSA puts its computers on the U.S. communications network and comes up with your or my name or telephone number, our names and our telephone numbers are going to be in the computers and the databases of the U.S. government forever, and that is there to be used against you if you were to apply for a U.S. government job or a security clearance or whatever.
We'll take another call now from Kevin in Washington, D.C. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Kevin. Go ahead.
Well, my name's not is David, but it's okay. My question was with regard to the chilling effect that this will have on reporters and other people in the journalistic areas, as they obviously can feel that their phones may be tapped, and how is it they will be able to provide protection for their confidential sources?
Well, in fact, as I understand it, Kate, many of the plaintiffs in the lawsuits against the phone companies are in fact some journalists, reporters, and others.
Yes, I think anyone who communicates with people overseas has to worry that their communications are being swept up by the NSA these days.
Well, there was a lawsuit in Detroit where folks like that were the plaintiffs. The Court of Appeals determined that they didn't have standing to pursue their case, and the Supreme Court recently declined to review that decision.
But Jim, aren't there also minimization procedures so that if something is intercepted that was in fact an innocuous call, the government is required to throw that out?
Well, they're required to minimize it. It doesn't literally mean, in every case, throwing it out. But, yes, they're not supposed to use it if it has nothing to do with foreign intelligence information.
And could I just add about that case? See, this is the catch-22 of the government secrecy. The reason why the case was thrown out is because the plaintiffs that included journalists, even though the president has admitted that he wiretapped Americans without a warrant, couldn't prove that they were the people wiretapped. In fact, there's nobody who can prove it. And so in the government's view of the law, no one is entitled to go to court and challenge the legality of the warrantless wiretapping because the government refuses to say which innocent people were overheard. So it's a catch-22 to their benefit.
We're talking this hour about the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and how best to amend that law. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I believe this is now Kevin in Washington, D.C. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a staff attorney with the nonprofit Electronic Frontier Foundation, and I wanted to make a comment about the retroactive immunity for the phone companies that Mr. Weinstein and the president are advocating for.
Sure.
I represent four average Americans in one of the lawsuits against AT&T for its participation in the NSA's warrantless wiretapping program. They, in turn, represent a class of 25 million AT&T customers who whistleblower evidence indicates had their phone calls and emails and communications records illegally sucked up in the NSA surveillance vacuum with AT&T's help. Now, I don't know who the president is talking about when he says the lawsuits against the phone companies were brought by greedy trial lawyers intent on hopping on some financial gravy train and saddling the companies with billions of dollars in damages. I, for my part, am a salaried nonprofit lawyer who doesn't stand to make a cent out of these lawsuits.
Kevin, can I just ask, how do your clients know they've been tapped if the program was secret?
Well, we have whistleblower evidence from a former AT&T technician indicating that in AT&T's Folsom Street facility, the fiber optic cables that carried all of the internet traffic through that facility, not just AT&T customers, but customers of other companies whose communications transit through AT&T, were mirrored into a secret room controlled by the NSA and containing sophisticated data mining equipment.
Okay, Kevin. Well, thanks for your call. Here's clearly an example of somebody who will be very tangibly affected by the outcome of this, whether the cases are thrown out or not. And, you know, Jim Baker, we've heard so much debate over whether telecom companies should get retroactive immunity. It seems like this is the real sticking point in this whole FISA debate. Is there any middle ground here? Is there a room for compromise?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure. We'll find out, I guess, in the next week or so whether there's room for compromise. Other proposals have been put forward where you would substitute the United States for the phone companies. So the phone companies would no longer have liability in terms of having to pay money. The United States government would step in, but the lawsuits could go forward so the plaintiffs and so on could get their answers. That's some of the ideas. There are other ideas out there to put the case into the FISA court so that the issue I talked about before with the secrecy would be and the risk to the sources and methods would be covered. So those are some of the other ideas. Whether those will be part of the solution, I really don't know.
And actually, we have another question here that I think is intended for you, Jim. Alan Butler writes, I'm listening with interest. One question, what percentage, if any, of the requests for surveillance warrants were denied by the FISA court?
The government reports those figures every year, so there should be another report come April of this year. But, you know, going back in recent memory, it's a very small percentage. It's a very small percentage. It's less than 1%. I haven't done the math on that, but it's a very small number. So,
you know, Kate, I don't want to sound too negative here, but it sounds as though many civil liberties groups have been on the losing ends of the FISA debate over the last few months and years. What do you attribute that to? And do you think that now, as it looks like some final resolution is coming, this might be one that you could win?
I think that what's happened until quite recently is a couple of things. It's been made a partisan issue. Attorney General Ashcroft and President Bush and Vice President Cheney made surveillance rules on Americans a partisan issue from the very beginning. The administration has repeatedly misled the American people about what's at stake. If you listen to the president and you listen to the director of national intelligence, they talk about listening to terrorists overseas. Now, Senator Feingold made clear that he was happy to exempt listening to terrorists overseas. So I think that the American people have become more skeptical. And that's not necessarily good, because we should have a president and administration that we can believe in. I'm hopeful that this whole dispute will end up not simply on the immunity issue, but on securing real court protections for Americans' privacy.
Kate Martin is director of the Center for National Security Studies, a civil liberties group, and Jim Baker spent almost 12 years working at the Justice Department's Office of Intelligence Policy Review. They both joined me here in Studio 3A today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the religious right has a long history of charismatic leadership. On the opinion page this week, David Kuo speculates who might be the next leader of the movement. I'm Ari Shapiro. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.